Hamartiology is the study of sin. Hamartia is the Greek word for sin. One of my chief problems with lordship theology is that it has a rather low view of sin. You read some rather extreme lordship theologians. I mean, if you want to go really far, you would go into the holiness Wesleyan camp, where you have people that said, I haven't sinned since 1992. But even other lordship theologians that we read, they give the impression that we can stop sinning, or that we mostly don't sin, or, I mean, what is it? You pick up on it when you read them. It seems like they've redefined sin. The best way I can explain this is that from a biblical viewpoint, if we were to track how many sins we commit, it would be like, you know, those gas meters on the back of your house that they click and track how much gas, natural gas you've used. If we had like a sin meter on our backs, that thing would just be going all day long. Thought, word, and deed, intentions, idols of the heart, selfishness, ego. When we study the topic of sin, far more worse than just mere disobedience. It's not less than disobedience. It's far more than disobedience. This would include omission, failing to do what I ought to have done. My attitudes in my heart can be sinful. My motives for doing the things that I do can be sinful. D.A. Carson gives the example of a young couple that foregoes everything to become missionaries. They sell their house, they walk away from their high-powered careers to go across to the other end of the world to serve in Bangladesh in complete poverty. And he says, yeah, that's really altruistic, but isn't there just a little part of them that kind of feels like, aren't we spiritual? Isn't there just something in there that says, look at what we gave up for Christ? I mean, even down to our motives, that everything you do, like, perhaps you're leading somebody to Christ. Isn't there a sliver, I mean, if not more, of some kind of selfish ambition involved in that? Or you wanting to get something, you wanting to see something? That's sin. That's sin. Think of Mark 7:21. From within, out of the heart of men, proceed the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. Jesus says that comes from the human heart. It's not just my behavior, in other words. Jesus says the problem is within. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. Galatians 5:19, now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality. Now those are pretty obvious sins in evangelical churches, right? We'd recognize those as, oh, yeah, those are the wicked ones. But then he says, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, hating somebody, strife, causing strife among believers, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these of which I forewarn you. So, yeah, we got the outward sins. Those are there. And right in between, I mean, outward, inward, inward, outward, Paul just has them all meshed in together into this little sin soup where it's like all of that is sin. Here's Dr. Larry Crabb and his really wonderful book, Understanding People. He says, many pastors preach an iceberg view of sin. All they worry about is what is visible above the waterline. That's a good image. You got an iceberg and maybe 5-10% is at the top what you can see. The problem is what's underneath, the human heart. Like a naive ship captain steering his vessel around the tip of the iceberg with no awareness that there is a mountain of ice beneath the surface that could wreck his ship, Christian leaders are too often satisfied when their people turn from church-defined sins of behavior. Turn from church-defined sins of behavior. Turning into a nice person, doing the right thing, behaving. And again, we're not saying we want less than that. There's nothing wrong with that. Fleeing from sin, changing. We're just saying that is fully inadequate. When we're actually dealing with something that goes down into the human heart, just to say we're going to change a couple of behaviors and do something different, that just is not going to cut it. Here's J.I. Packer. He's a New Testament theologian. He says, sin is the moral equivalent of a wolf in sheep's clothing, presenting itself to us again and again as good, desirable, and a necessity of life, thereby corrupting our conscience so that we lose the sense of its guiltiness and cherish it as if it were a friend rather than an enemy. You ever read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis? It's a picture of people that they get this one last chance to leave hell and go to heaven. And so they hop on this bus to go to heaven, and an angel is going to guide them there to the mountains. That's where God is in his metaphor, allegory. The whole thing is basically an allegory for people right now in hell, quote unquote, on earth. And the things which lead them to the mountains are the things that keep them away. So it's kind of a cool study. Anyways, one of the pictures that Lewis has is this man who has this lizard growing out of his neck. And the angel comes up to him and he's like, if you want to go to the mountains, you got to cut that off. And the guy's like, oh, I don't know. I kind of like it there. And he's like, well, you have your choice. I can cut that off for you. It's actually going to feel really good to be done with it. And then I can take you to God. He's in the mountains. And so the guy's like, all right, go ahead. And angel pulls up his sword and he goes, whoa, okay, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I'm just saying, let's just think about this for a little bit, okay? I just want to hold on to this for a little while. And the angel's like, I'm not going to make you do it. He's like, okay, cut it off. Raises his sword again. Oh, hold on a second. I mean, is there any way we can just talk about this a little bit more? And they go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And you realize that the lizard is sin. That's what Lewis is saying. That this person has this grotesque thing growing out of his neck like a mutated lizard goiter, you know, and he's looking at that thing and he's like, I want to give it up. I hate it. And yet it's a friend. I'm comfortable with it. I love it. I can't give it up. Well, finally, do you want me to ruin the ending? He goes back to hell and burns forever. No, I'm kidding. Lewis doesn't have that picture of hell in the book. He pictures hell as loneliness, self-governance. But finally, the guy is like, all right, do it. And he chops it off, and he just realizes that his head was at an angle the whole time. And he goes, puts his head up straight, and he goes, wow, that feels so good to be free of that. That's really a picture of sin. We love it. We love sin. We want more of it. We don't want to be done with it. We hang on to it. We think of it as a friend rather than an enemy. Here's a question which plagues us. Let's throw this out for discussion. Do you think Christians should have a growing sense of their own sinfulness? I better stop. What do you think? Should Christians have a growing sense of their own sinfulness? Yeah. So it could be something that God grows us in, but you're saying the necessary component for this to be healthy, should maturing Christians, growing Christians have a greater sense of their own sinfulness? You're saying this could be a good thing for a growing Christian, provided they're also deeply appreciating the grace of God at the same time. Well, that's pretty good. Yeah, what do you think? So, yeah, I agree. We got to be very careful. That some people think I keep talking about what a sinner I am. How about the person who shares at home church every week about their struggle, and I fell again, and I'm so selfish, and then it just ends. The comment ends. And you're just like, oh, God, you didn't learn any? Like, what's the lesson you got out of it? None of that. There could be a form of pseudo-spirituality where we're just always talking about sin all the time, and it could actually be pretty destructive. It's possible. Maybe another way of thinking about this is it that we are trying to discover our sin? Or is it that as we mature, God reveals it to us? That's approaching God in Adam. That's approaching God based on who I was. I'm dead to that person. I think this is God's role. I think God reveals this over time. And as he reveals that, it's our job to turn and cling to grace. I would have to believe that this is true. Some of the most mature believers I know, whom I respect, are men and women who realize just how sinful, inadequate they really are. And I believe it's biblical. Think of 1 Corinthians 15. Paul says, I am the least of the apostles, not fit to even be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. Yes, this was written, when was 1 Corinthians written? 51 AD, somewhere in there. Then we get to Ephesians, a prison epistle, Ephesians 3:9. To me, the very least of all the apostles, the very least of all the saints. This grace was given to me to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ. That was written probably in the early 60s, probably 60, 61, if memory serves correctly. So Paul had been serving the Lord another decade and discovers, you know, it's not just that I'm worse than all the apostles, I'm worse than all believers. Then at the end of his life, 1 Timothy 1:15, this could be written around 64 AD, he says, Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, among whom I am foremost of all. I'm not just the worst of apostles or the worst of believers, I'm the worst of all sinners. Some people take Paul to be speaking hyperbolically there. It's just exaggeration for the point of effect. It really seems to me that he believed that. The way that Leffel puts it is, we're always judging other people for how sinful they are. This guy I'm living with, what a sinner, and she's a sinner, and she's so this, and she's so that. One of the things Leff points out is, the only person whom you know deeply and truly is yourself. The only person whose motives you really know from time to time are your own. He says, so really, you're the most sinful person you know. I thought that was kind of a clever way of putting it. I know myself, I know my own sin. Why am I walking around like I'm such a big deal when I know just how deeply flawed I am? I like to think about it this way. Think of one of these spiraling staircases. Imagine that this is really a illustration for walking with the Lord over the years. Okay, if you look at the bottom row here, imagine this is when you're a new believer and you've got a real anger issue. You run into these hysterical, infantile fits where you blow up and slam the door and chew people out and burst into tears, scream and yell. And, you know, year one, all of a sudden, you're starting to really deal with that. Like, it's pretty bad. And the Lord brings you up those stairs to the point where he's like, are you going to go up or are you going to go down? And so you choose to take up your identity, you choose to trust him, and you learn about your false beliefs, and God energizes you and brings victory. And then a few years go by, and you're walking around that staircase again, you hit year three, and there you are again with your infantile anger outbursts. And you're thinking to yourself, I already dealt with this. I mean, here we go again. I keep having this, what's called a besetting sin. And the Lord is like, do you want to go up or do you want to go down? And you choose to trust him again. You're like, yeah, I want to grow even more. And you go around that staircase a few more times. This time you get married. And instead of having several roommates, you just have one roommate. And you discover what a dysfunctional person he or she is, only to discover how dysfunctional you are. And all of a sudden the infantile anger fits come out again. And you're using words against your spouse you forgot you knew. And then again, you're like, God's like, are you going to trust me in this life situation? And then you have kids. You're 12. And your kids start to disobey you. And your kids start to be frantic. And in fact, they're being infantile toward you. Because they're infants. And your anger is blowing up again. How dare they treat me that way? And you're slamming doors again, and there it is again. It's like you don't feel like you're going up a spiral staircase. You feel like you're on one of those hamster cycles. You know what I mean? Here I am again. And yet, when you look down from the 12th floor, you get a much different picture. You see the point of the illustration. Sometimes it feels like, here we go again. I'm a sinner. I'm messed up. I'm broken. I don't know what's wrong with me. And yet the Lord sometimes will give you these memories of, do you even remember what it was like year one? And you realize how much you've grown. Yes, it's a besetting sin. Yes, here it is again. And yes, you have grown. This is really the paradox of spiritual growth. When you first come to Christ, somebody gives you the gospel and you realize God's righteous and I'm sinful. And yet you have kind of this feeling like, yeah, God, he's pretty righteous and I'm pretty sinful, yeah. But the gap between the two really isn't that big. You know what I'm saying? Like maybe I've done some things wrong. I need forgiven. Maybe there's one thing that you remember in particular. Like when I came to Christ, there were certain things that came to mind where I was like, wow, that thing, that gory, ugly, sinful, inexcusable thing I did is forgiven. And yet when you continue to grow with the Lord, you start to get a higher view of just how righteous God is. Whoa, he is way more righteous than I thought. And then you start to discover just how much more sinful you are. And so on and so forth. You grow even further and you're like, whoa, God is even more righteous and I'm even more sinful. Really, these lines should just go off the page to the point where we could truly grasp the tremendous depth of the grace of God and just how utterly sinful I am. The paradox is this: no matter how sinful you think you are, you're worse. When I came to Christ, I could think of a couple of things that were pretty heinous. Things that as a non-believer I had done and I felt tremendous guilt over. And yet God was looking at that and he was like, yeah, that's pretty bad, real bad. Your life is way worse. It's kind of like you're looking at a car and you're looking at that one flat tire and you're like, it's flat, it's really bad, but the whole thing is rusted out. The other paradox is this, is no matter how loved you think you are by God, you're far more loved. You can't out-love God. That should be something to reflect upon, to think about. I can't outgive him. I can't outlove him. I don't deserve any of this. Lord, I'm coming to you here again, totally in no other way besides in Christ. Thank you that you accept me again. Hamartiology, really we see that sin goes very, very deep. Let's just take a quick purview here. Think of your close relationships. You don't have to write these down. Have I been the kind of roommate that I could or should have been? Have I been the kind of spouse that I could or should have been today? Just today. You don't have to look over the last year. Think about having a critical spirit of people around me. Have I unrighteously judged people today? You know, in the first 3 seconds of seeing my friend, and there we go again. And I have no idea what they're going through. I don't know what they've been through. Envy and jealousy. Have I unrighteously compared my performance to someone else today? Have I ever had the thought, man, I could do a better job than that. Why don't they let me do that? Jealousy, inconsiderate or insensitivity to others. Did someone in my life have a need that I didn't meet out of coldness or indifference? For those of you who are more reflective temperaments, you should think about this. A lot of times you're the wallflower looking back on everyone else and I can see everyone else's sin, but I don't have any sin. Oh, yes, you do. You're cold, you're unloving, you're indifferent to this ocean of needs around you. People need you and what are you doing? Nothing. Sitting there. Did I ignore a phone call or text message from someone who needed my help? On that text line, hypersensitivity. Did I dwell on someone's comment all day long, wondering what they meant by that? I hate putting this one up here. I'll be home washing dishes, just thinking to myself, what the heck did he mean by that? Was he talking about me? I bet he was talking about me. In fact, I think he was calling me out there. That's being hypersensitive. That is, you know, as believers, we want to have a soft heart, but we want to have a thick skin where people can say things and they don't have to feel like, what's the expression, walking on eggshells, because I'm just afraid if I say the wrong thing, I'm going to offend him or offend her. You need to give up the self-righteous, hypersensitive attitude, learn to be a little bit more forgiving. Love keeps no record of wrongs. I can't build in deep with people. People don't love me. It might be because you're hypersensitive. And people don't like to be around you because they feel judged all the time. Did I judge someone based on their comment rather than clearing things up right away? Did I have to go and talk to 8 different people about what that meant instead of just saying, what do you mean by that? I didn't know what that meant. Am I getting my feelings hurt all the time? That is unloving. Do you realize that? Walking around with your feelings hurt. Yes, we get our feelings hurt and we're going to get hurt. The Bible doesn't say anywhere, thou shalt not hurt people's feelings. We're adults. We're going to hurt. You're getting hurt. You're going to hurt other people too. How many times have you hurt somebody else's feelings and didn't know about it? Yes, it hurts. And yet, that's hypersensitivity. 1 Corinthians 13:5. Love does not take into account the wrong suffered. That's not love. You know who gets picked on the most in my home church is me. A lot of times it's my love language. I kind of like it. But then other times they say something where you're like, that's what I'm really insecure about. No, don't say that. It hurts. It's just like, whatever. We're not going to take a record of wrongs. Love covers a multitude of sins. 1 Peter 4:8. It is to a man's glory that he overlooks an offense. Proverbs 25. I want you to think about that. I've been hurt. It's to my glory to overlook that. I'm not going to be a hypersensitive person. What about controlling behavior? Do I always have to be the person to drive? Controller. I can't let anyone else drive. Gotta be the one to do it. Can I enjoy something even if it isn't my plan or idea? Oh, we're all going to Roosters after group tonight. Nah, I don't like that. I just want to go back to the porch and sit around and drink Pabst Blue Ribbon and relate real deeply. Let's go out. Let's try and get behind other people. You're controlling. That's what you're doing. You're holding everyone hostage. You're protesting. Autonomy. Do I act independently of the needs of other people? We're not just all an island unto ourselves, as one author put it. We're in community here. I'm in the body of Christ. What? I'm just going to sit up there in my bedroom and just be totally bunkered in there like I'm General Patton, you know, keeping everyone out. That's autonomy. That's we got people out here with needs. What's the big deal? What do you care what I'm doing? Brother, we got people out here with needs. And what, you're just going to be, you know, packed away from people? That's sin. That's what you call that. Am I too prideful to ask for advice or counsel? Do I show up to people telling them my plan and then saying, yeah, I'm going to do that. And that's my way of asking for advice. How about showing up and saying, I'm thinking about this. Could you help me? I don't know what to do here. This is what I'm thinking. Would you speak into this? I need help. Sins of omission. James 4:17. To the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Sin. He calls it evil in verse 16. The world system. We haven't even tapped into this. Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. These people who talk about, especially these Western, opulent, affluent Christians who are like, yeah, we can't continue in sin. And meanwhile, they're in, you know, an enormous mansion and driving impeccable cars and are sitting on a ton of cash. What do you mean we can't continue in sin? This is what you have to do. You have to lower what sin is in order to justify that we can't keep going on in sin. Truly, we are sinning all day, every hour, every minute. Which brings us to a few words about grace. Probably my favorite part in the whole class. You guys ever read this? William Newell. Romans verse by verse. This is a good commentary, good author, and a good section. This is from the subtitle, A Few Words About Grace. He speaks about the nature of grace. He says, grace is God acting freely according to his own nature as love, with no promises or obligations to fulfill and acting, of course, righteously in view of the cross. True or false? I would have to agree with the Calvinists on this. God is free to give grace to whomever, whenever, however he wants. Grace means a gift. I could never stand here and say, I deserve to have this blessing from God or that blessing from God. God decides if he wants to give grace or not. Grace, therefore, is uncaused in the recipient. Its cause lies wholly in the giver, in God. Showing up to God with some sort of meritorious behavior. Well, I've really been in my word this week, Lord. I've really been praying to you for a long time about this, Lord. I've been pleading with you. Why haven't you come through on this yet? Why haven't you given me the yet? Grace is uncaused in the recipient. There's nothing we do to merit it. Grace also is sovereign, not having debts to pay or fulfilled condition on man's part to wait for. It can act toward whom and how it pleases. It can and does often place the worst deservers in the highest favors. Yeah. Why do I get to lead such an awesome life? Why am I here right now? Why is God using me? You know, the longer you do the kind of work that we do, serving people, building a personal ministry, leading, sharing your faith, building up fellow believers, you start to wonder, why am I getting blessed? It could very well be because you're the least deserving. You have some people, honestly, this is pretty confusing. I don't quite understand it. I remember working with two guys. One guy was a good, godly man. I mean good. Read his word every day. Prayerful. Serving people. Lover of people. He had been trying to reach out and reach people for Christ for over a year. Couldn't get anything going. The other guy I was meeting with, into pornography 4, 5, 6 times a week. One time it was 4 times a day. Pretty selfish, pretty self-confident, pretty fleshly. And God was using him all over the place to lead people to Christ. And people were following him too. And it was real. I mean, it was not, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, it's very often the people you look at that you're like, why him? Why give him the blessing? I don't know. Sometimes God just enjoys giving grace to people who don't deserve it. Grace cannot act where there is either deserving nor ability. Grace does not help. It is absolute. It does all. True or false? I think that's true. It's got to be true. This isn't self-effort. It's not like God is coming alongside us to help us. We're going to get into what our role is, and we don't want to diminish that. But grace does its work in us. There being no cause in the creature why grace should be shown, the creature must be bought off from trying to give cause to God for his grace. Well, I've been in my word. I've been serving. I've been faithful. Father, I've been with you this entire time, and you're going to give grace to the prodigal son? That's trying to buy God off. And God's like, you don't twist my arm. You know what that is? That's paganism. Pagan deities, what you would do is you would perform a sacrifice. And if you're going to take an ocean trip, you sacrifice to Poseidon, to propitiate Poseidon, make him happy so that you'd have a propitious voyage, right? Or if you're going to give a really, you know, good talk in court, you know, you'd have to propitiate that god, the god of speech. Or if you're going to war, you propitiate the god of Hermes. What do you do to propitiate a god who has no needs? There's nothing to barter with. It's like sitting down with Bill Gates and saying, yeah, I'm really going to barter with you over how much I'm going to sell my house for. He's just going to walk away. He has no needs. We can't buy him off. If there's any reason for him to love us or give us anything, it's going to be completely on his end. 100%. Yeah, I think that's true. The discovery by the creature that he is truly the object of divine grace works the utmost humility. For the receiver of grace is brought to know his absolute unworthiness and his complete inability to attain worthiness, yet he finds himself blessed on another principle outside of himself. Why is my life so awesome? Why is God providing? I don't know, because he's good. really has nothing to do with me. Therefore, flesh has no place in the plan of grace. This is the great reason why grace is hated by the proud, natural mind of man. But for this very reason, the true believer rejoices, for he knows that in him, that is, in his flesh, is no good thing. There you go, Romans 7. And yet he finds God glad to bless him, just as he is. The place of man under grace. He has been accepted in Christ, who is his standing. He is not on probation. That's what some theologians would have you believe, that it's, well, you could sin enough that God's testing you out. He's going to throw you back into prison. There is no probation. As to his life past, it does not exist before God. He died at the cross, and Christ is his life. Remember that newspaper article, James Rochford is dead. He's history. And now we got this new creation. Grace once bestowed is not withdrawn, for God knew all the human exigencies beforehand, the different possibilities. His action was independent of them, not dependent upon them. This is for where you fall into sin, and then you wonder, is God still there? Is he going to bless me? Does he still accept me? Does he still love me? God knew all the exigencies beforehand. He knew you were going to do this. And he still says, I still love you. The failure of devotion does not cause the withdrawal of bestowed grace as it would under law. It's not that I have to work, otherwise he's going to pull his grace away. What about the place of man under grace? Newell writes, to believe and to consent to be loved while unworthy, this is the great secret. It's not just consenting, it's believing it. I trust that. I don't deserve it. I am unworthy, and I just need to accept that. I'm so loved by God. Thank you, God. To refuse to make resolutions and vows for that is to trust in the flesh. I'm never going to do this again, God. Really? Says who? Says your flesh. I fell into it again and again, but this is the last time. How could you possibly promise that? Well, I drank too much again, but it's never going to happen again. That's your flesh trying to promise God something that you can't promise. You are fundamentally flawed. Instead, just to turn to him and say, I trust you that you're going to change me here. To expect to be blessed, though realizing more and more the lack of worth. When you get into teaching the Bible, you see this more and more. You know, I remember we moved houses. We were moving from our current house, our last apartment, into our new house. And I don't know if you've been through, well, you have. You've been through these house moves. Talk about carnal mindset. I mean, going from moving our stuff and getting it set up, and I'm working harder than him, and he's not really pulling. And is that his third cigarette break of the afternoon? And, you know, we were moving, and people were annoying, and my stuff wasn't where it wanted to be, and I just wanted to lay down and sleep. And it's just like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, my bed's not made. I don't have clean clothes. I smell. And I remember getting up to teach that week at CT, and I was in the flesh. Dear God, I was angry. I was frustrated. I was looking for stimulation. I was looking, it was bad. And I remember getting up to teach CT right before that and just being like, God, do I even dare to ask you to bless this teaching tonight? With where I've been this week and the thoughts I've been thinking and what I've been doing, and do I even dare to come into your presence and ask you to bless? And God would answer to that, I wouldn't be offended if you did. I'd be offended if you didn't. To come directly into his presence and expect a blessing, even knowing I don't deserve one at all. To testify of God's goodness at all times, not just when I'm being blessed, but I know that I am blessed. To be certain of God's future favor, yet to be ever more tender in conscience toward him. It's not that we would use this as a license to sin. It's that we realize just how deep the grace of God is, that he's going to bless me, a sinner. Why would he do that? And you start to realize, oh my God, he is so good. Why would I want to turn away from him now? to rely on God's chastening hand as a mark of his kindness. I'm going through God's discipline again. It can't be because he's angry with me. It can't be because he hates me. He's trying to punish me. It's, well, if he's put this into my life, it must be because he loves me. A man under grace, if like Paul, has no burdens regarding himself, but many about others. I mean, you could see the logic of that, couldn't you? If you feel so centered and taken care of, I have no needs. And I'm going to go out there and start to serve other people. Well, he says, gracious souls discover to hope to be better is to fail to see yourself in Christ only. What do you think about that one? I don't know. Paul says it's not that I have attained it, but I reach on toward the hope of my calling, Philippians 3. I think there could be an aspect where we want to grow. We want to get better and in our condition, not in our position. Maybe that's what he's thinking of. To be disappointed with self is to have believed in self. Well, there's a good line. I remember falling into sin pretty bad, going back to my house that night, laying up, looking at the ceiling. I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I did that. I remember just repeating that over and over and over. How did that happen? How can I do that? It's as if God was asking me, so what? You're such a holy man. You're such a righteous, holy liver. You couldn't believe you, of all people, could do that. Of course, you, of anyone who should be able to do that, James, it's you, you sinful freak, right? Of course you can. But to have been disappointed in self is to have believed in self. I must really be trusting in myself. I must have a higher view of myself than I should. Higher view of my flesh, that is. To be discouraged is unbelief as to God's purpose and plan of blessing for you. To be proud is to be blind, for we have no standing before God in ourselves. The lack of divine blessing, therefore, comes from unbelief and not from failure of devotion. This could be that my unbelief is blocking the blessing of God. Or it could be that God is blessing me, but I can't see it. That he has blessed my life, I don't believe it. Hey, you could take it either way. Real devotion to God arises not from man's will to show it, but from the discovery that blessing has been received from God while we were yet unworthy and undevoted. To preach devotion first and blessing second is to reverse God's order and to preach law, not grace. The law made man's blessing depend on devotion. Grace confers undeserved, unconditional blessing. Our devotion may follow, but doesn't always do so in proper measure. Well, that's an understatement. Never, never enough. We could never pay back God for what he's done. You should pick up that commentary. Quite good. Yeah, that section is really good. You know who really loved that commentary? Chuck Smith. He said that was a formative commentary in his walk. As we wrap up here tonight, one of the main takeaways is that legalism occurs when we don't teach or we don't emphasize the indicatives. You could have somebody up there teaching the truth. I'm just up here teaching the truth. Yeah, but you didn't emphasize what God emphasizes. That sounded like a sermon from First Fundamentalist Church down the street. Law, 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 law. Well, where was the part about God's power, the hope of the gospel of Christ, that he can change us, the new identity that I'm resting in him? Where was that? It wasn't in there. You can sit through some teachers for years without hearing a word about the new identity. Often we feel the most sinful when we're being used by God the most. This is kind of the way it is for me. People are different, and I don't know what it is for you, but my experience has been to kind of leap without looking. And so people are like, you want to play this role? And I'm like, yeah. And then I get in there, and then 6 months later, I'm like, man, either they made a mistake or I made a mistake. It's like you take on this new role or more of an influence, and then that's when you start to discover just how weak, unable I am to do any of this. And it's not that you became more sinful, it's just that it was revealed how sinful you really were the whole time. Just think of that servant that Nee talks about. When you're not doing anything, you look very sinless. But when you start to work, that's when you start to show how clumsy you are. So if you're in this stage, you're trying to step it up with your walk and make more of an influence, don't be surprised if you discover just how many things are coming to the surface. The question is, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to cling to grace, or are you going to stay there in Romans 7 and drown?